I have been asked to give my opinion regarding the return of Jesus Christ, the Great Tribulation, the last scales or plagues in the book of Revelations, and the thousand years of peace. In this podcast, I will share with you how I understand Scripture regarding the so-called Great Tribulation. I will cover, God willing, the other events in separate podcasts. These are my personal opinions, and in no way do I claim that this is the only and or most correct explanation of the scriptures in question. The Apostle Paul said that we all know only in part and we look into a dim mirror. In other words, although all expositors attempt to explain God's word to the best of their ability, not all offer the same solution to the many and often difficult matters recorded in the Bible. We must at all times respect others' points of view with an open mind and accept each other as brothers and sisters in the love of Jesus Christ. The event described in Matthew 24, Mark 13 and Luke 21 mainly concerns the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. In response to one of Jesus' disciples who marveled at the large and beautiful stones of the temple, Jesus said, "Not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down." When Jesus and his disciples came to the Mount of Olives, some of the disciples wanted to know what he meant. In what is generally referred to as the Olivet Discourse, Jesus answered their questions in detail. Preachers tend to treat this event, usually from Matthew's version, without considering Mark and Luke's versions. As a result thereof, many explanations of Jesus' second coming and the so-called Great Tribulation are often taken out of context. Matthew contains more information on the subject than Mark and Luke, but unfortunately it is also more difficult to place the various events in a logical order. Albert Barnes says that to these questions Jesus replies not by noticing them distinctly, but he intermingles the events of the destruction of Jerusalem with that of the end of the world. It is therefore sometimes difficult to determine to what event his remarks apply. It appears that some of his remarks could be applied to both the destruction of Jerusalem and the end of the world. A similar use of language is found in some parts of Isaiah, where the same language will describe the return from the Babylonian captivity as well as the deliverance by the Messiah. It is important to understand that when Jesus spoke to his disciples on the Mount of Olives, nobody recorded his specific words in shorthand. The Gospels were not written down until many years after Jesus' crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension. It is therefore reasonable to expect that there can be differences in the recorded version of Jesus' discussion on the Mount of Olives. For this discussion, I will use Matthew's version as my primary source, and with the help of Mark and Luke, I will do my best to eliminate any confusion. One of Jesus' disciples marveled at the large stones that were used to build the temple. He said to Jesus, "Look, teacher, what massive stones, what magnificent buildings." Mark 13, verse 1. Jesus replied and said, "Do you see all these great buildings? Not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down." There is no question that the temple, built by Herod the Great, was an impressive building. Josephus, the great Jewish historian, said that in that temple were several stones which were 45 cubits in length, 5 in height, and 6 in breadth. That is more than 70 feet long, 10 feet wide, and 8 feet high. These enormous stones were used to build the high wall on the east side, from the base to the top of the mountain. They were also beautifully painted in a variety of colors. However, just to put things in perspective, the stones that the disciples raved about was those used in the construction of the temple and surrounding buildings. They were also huge, but not as large as the ones used for the retaining wall. Nevertheless, when Jesus spoke these words, nothing was more unheard of than what he predicted. The temple was vast, rich, and splendid. It was the pride of the people. In his discussion, Jesus said that there will be a great tribulation as never was before and never will again occur. In other words, it will be a period marked by great distress. This statement is the core of numerous explanations by scholars as to what Jesus meant, and especially when this tribulation will occur. The question is, has Jesus' prediction been fulfilled, and if so, when did it happen? Or has it not yet happened, and if so, when will it happen? Before I give you my interpretation of the subject, let me just briefly discuss the viewpoints of the main Christian eschatological schools of thought. Now, Christian eschatology is the study of the end times. Regarding the Great Tribulation, the different schools of thought can be summarized as follows. Number one, futurism. In the futurist view, the Great Tribulation is a relatively short period of time where everyone will experience worldwide hardships, persecution, disasters, famine, war, pain, and suffering. All of creation will be affected, and it will precede the judgment of all when Jesus returns. Among futurists, there are many different views about what will happen to Christians during this tribulation. Number two, preterism. In the preterist view, the tribulation took place in the past when Roman legions destroyed Jerusalem and the temple in AD 70. That was during the end stages of the first Jewish-Roman war. It only affected the Jewish people. Christian preterists believe that the tribulation was a divine judgment of the Jews for their sins, including their rejection of Jesus as the promised Messiah. Number three, historicism. The historicist view applies the tribulation to the period known as persecution of the saints, Daniel 7, Revelation 13. This, they believe, began with the period after the falling away, that is, from 538, when Papal Rome came to power, until 1798, when it lost its ultimate power over the people. The historicists believe that although the tribulation began with the appearance of Papal Rome, it continues until Jesus' return. Right at the end of the time, the tribulation will intensify to a time such as never been before. Matthew's reference to Great Tribulation as parallel to Revelation 6 verse 12 to 13 will reach a point that if it was not shortened, even the just would not survive. That is the main schools of thought regarding the Great Tribulation. Now, concerning the tribulation that Jesus predicted on the Mount of Olives, I firmly believe that his prediction was literally fulfilled about 40 years later. That is when Jerusalem was captured by the Roman armies, commanded by Titus in AD 70. However, according to Jesus, true Christians in this world will always experience some form of tribulation or distress, John 16 verse 33. After all, this world is not our home, we are just passing through. Josephus was a Jewish priest and historian who fell into the hands of the Romans. He stayed with them during the siege and destruction of the city, and he recorded the destruction of Jerusalem in his book Jewish Wars, Book 6. All my references to Josephus will be from this book. Josephus, being a Jew, would of course say nothing to confirm the prophecies of Jesus, yet his report appears almost like a running commentary on Jesus' predictions with respect to the destruction of the temple. He wrote that after the city was taken, Titus gave orders that they should demolish the entire city and temple, except for three towers and the wall on the west side of the city. But for all the rest of the wall, he said, it was thoroughly laid even with the ground by those who dug it up from the foundation. Nothing was left. The idea was that those who came to the city would not believe that it had ever been inhabited. Another Jewish writer, Maimonides, recorded that Terentius Ruthus, an officer in the army of Titus, tore up the foundations of the temple with a plowshare. In Micah 3 verse 12, we read, Zion shall be plowed as a field. Josephus said that Titus initially did not want to destroy the temple. He sent Josephus to the city, to the Jews, to negotiate their surrender and thereby save the temple and the city. However, the prediction of Jesus had gone forth, and notwithstanding the wish of the Roman general, the temple was to be destroyed. The Jews themselves set fire to the porticos of the temple. One of the Roman soldiers threw a burning firebrand into the golden window, and soon the temple was in flames. Titus gave orders to extinguish the fire, but amid the chaos, none of his orders were obeyed. The soldiers then stormed the temple, and nothing could restrain them. Their hatred of the Jews urged them on to the work of destruction, and thus, says Josephus, the temple was burned against the will of Caesar. Let's get back to what Jesus told his disciples. Mark 13 verse 3 to 4 reads, As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, opposite the temple, Peter, James, John and Andrew asked him privately, Tell us, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign that they are all about to be fulfilled? Luke 21 verse 7 reads, Teacher, they ask, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign that they are about to take place? Matthew 24 verse 3, however, reads, Tell us, they said, when will this happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Do you see the difference? Mark and Luke agree. There are two questions in their request, namely, 1. When will these things be? That is, when will the temple be torn down? And 2. What is the sign when it will happen? That is, what is the sign or signs they should look for that will precede the destruction? In Matthew's version, Mark and Luke's second question is replaced with, What is the sign of your coming and of the end of the age, or the world according to some translations? And this is where Matthew's version gets tricky. Let's think logically. Jesus makes a statement that the temple will be destroyed and that not one stone will be left on another. However, he says nothing here about his second coming. The logical question of his disciples will then be, when will this, that is the destruction of the temple, happen, and what sign or signs will precede it? Jesus said that the demolition of the temple and everything that will accompany it will be preceded by all kinds of things that must first happen, to which they should pay attention. They must not be deceived by all the things that they will see, hear and experience. Jesus then tells them what things will happen before the temple will be destroyed, namely, number 1. Many will come in his name claiming to be the Christ, that is the Messiah, and they will deceive many people. Number 2, the disciples will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but this is not the end. Number 3, nations and kingdoms shall revolt against each other. Number 4, famines, pestilences and earthquakes will occur in various places, but these are just the beginning of sorrows. Number 5, the disciples will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and they will be hated by all the nations for his name's sake. Number 6, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. Number 7, many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Number 8, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. Only after all these things which Jesus mentioned have happened will there be a sign or event that will signal the destruction of the temple. So what will this sign be? Jesus said to his disciples, When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, then let those in Judea flee into the mountains. In the International Standard Version we read, when you see the destructive desecration mentioned by prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. This is the sign that will precede the breaking down of the stones which fascinated the disciples. This is the beginning of a great tribulation. I will now examine what Jesus said in more detail. Number 1. Jesus said, take heed that no man deceive you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and will deceive many. In other words, the disciples should constantly be on guard, because there will be much deception. There was a general expectation among the Jews that the Messiah would appear in their time, and that he will overturn the yoke of the Romans. It was no wonder that those who claimed to be the Messiah were easily followed by multitudes who believed in them. Now there is abundant evidence that this was fully accomplished. Josephus tells us that there were many who claimed divine inspiration who deceived the people, leading great numbers of them into the desert. He said, the land was overrun with magicians, seducers, and impostors who drew the people after them in multitudes into solitudes and deserts to see the signs and miracles which they promised to show by the power of God. Among these were Dositheus, the Samaritan, who affirmed that he was Christ. Also, Simon Magus, who said he appeared among the Jews as the Son of God, and Theudas, who persuaded many to go with him to the river Jordan to see the waters divided. Number 2. The disciples will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but this is not the end. It is recorded in the history of Rome that violent revolts prevailed in the Roman Empire before the destruction of Jerusalem. 4 emperors, Nero, Galba, Otto, and Vitellius, all died a violent death in the short period of 18 months. As a result of these changes in government, there was turmoil throughout the empire. Parties who aligned with particular emperors were formed, with the result that bloody and violent wars broke out. This is remarkable if we consider that when Jesus gave this prophecy, the Roman Empire was in a state of peace. Jesus said there will be rumors of wars. Some wars have been declared that have not been carried out. Josephus said that Bardanes and after him Vologes declared war against the Jews, but it did not take place. He also said that Vitellius, governor of Syria, declared war against Aretas, king of Arabia, and he wished to lead his army through Palestine, but the death of Tiberius prevented the war. But, Jesus also said, it is not yet the end. That is, the destruction of Jerusalem will not follow immediately, so they should not be overly worried when they hear such rumors. Number 3. Nations and kingdoms shall revolt against each other. In Caesarea, the Jews and Armenians fought over the right to the city, and 20,000 of the Jews were killed. The massacre alarmed the Jewish nation, with the result that they waged war against Syrian cities and towns. Rebellion and civil war spread throughout Judea. Italy was also plunged into civil war by the rivalry between Otto and Vitellius for the crown. Number 4. Famines, pestilences, and earthquakes will occur in various places, but these are just the beginning of sorrows. Now, famines. There was a famine foretold by Agabus, Acts 11:28, which is mentioned by Tacitus, Suetonius, and Eusebius, and which was so severe in Jerusalem, says Josephus, that many people perished for want of food. 4 times in the reign of Claudius, 41 to 54, famine prevailed in Rome, Palestine and Greece. Pestilences. Not all Bible translations mention pestilences. Nevertheless, it usually accompanies famine and is often the result thereof. A pestilence is recorded by Josephus as raging in Babylonia 40 AD, and Tacitus recorded a pestilence in Italy in 66 AD. Both took place before the destruction of Jerusalem. Earthquakes. In prophetic language, earthquakes sometimes means political upheaval. Literally, they are tremors or shakings of the earth which often damage cities and towns. Many of these are mentioned as preceding the destruction of Jerusalem. Tacitus mentions an earthquake that occurred in Rome during the reign of Claudius. He also says that during the reign of Nero, the cities of Laodicea, Hierapolis and Colossae were overthrown, and the celebrated Pompeii was almost destroyed by an earthquake. Others are mentioned that happened in Smyrna, Miletus, Chios and Samos. Luke adds, "And terrible things and signs will be from heaven." Luke 21 verse 11. Josephus, who probably never heard of this prophecy and who certainly would not have done anything intentionally to confirm its fulfillment, records the wonders and signs which he says preceded the destruction of the city. A star, he said, which looked like a sword stood over the city. Also, there was a comet that continued for a whole year. On another occasion at the Feast of Unleavened Bread, during the night, a bright light shone around the altar and the temple, so bright that it seemed like daylight for half an hour. The eastern gate of the temple, made of solid brass, and which was so heavy it took 20 men to close it, opened of itself in the night. A few days after that festival, he says, before sunset, chariots and troops of soldiers in their armor were seen running about among the clouds. Also a loud noise, such as the sound of a multitude, was heard in the temple, saying, "Let us depart from here." 4 years before the war began, a man named Jesus, he was the son of Ananias, came to the Feast of Tabernacles when the city was in peace and prosperity, and began to cry aloud, "A voice from the east, a voice from the west, a voice from the four winds, a voice against Jerusalem and the holy house, a voice against the bridegroom and the brides, and a voice against the whole people." He was scourged, and with each stroke of the whip he cried out, "Woe, woe to Jerusalem." This cry, says Josephus, was continued every day for more than 7 years, until he was killed in the siege of the city, crying out, "Woe, woe, to me also." Jesus said, "All these things are the beginning of sorrows." In other words, a far heavier calamities are yet to come before the end. Number 5. The disciples will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and they will be hated by all the nations for his name's sake. Mark 13 verse 9 reads, "For they shall deliver you up to Sanhedrins, and in the synagogues you shall be beaten, and you shall be brought before rulers and kings for my sake, for a testimony against them." Peter and John were imprisoned, Acts 4 verse 3. Also Paul and Silas, Acts 16 verse 24. Acts 18 verse 12 reads, "While Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews gathered together, attacked Paul, and brought him before the judge's seat." In Acts 24, Paul appears before Governor Felix, and in Acts 25, he testified before King Agrippa. Stephen was stoned, Acts 7 verse 59. James was killed by Herod, Acts 12, 12. And the persecution under Nero took place before the destruction of Jerusalem, in which, with many others, Peter and Paul were killed. Most of the apostles, it is believed, died through persecution because they believed in Jesus. Number 6. Many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. Many of those who once accepted Jesus backslided and even denied him. Jesus rightly said, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven." Luke adds that they, that is the true disciples, will be betrayed by parents and brothers and relatives and friends. That's Luke 21 verse 16. They would break the most tender ties to deliver Christians to punishment. So great would their hatred for Christians be that it would overcome all the natural loves of family and home. This, unfortunately, often occurred. Number 7. Many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Many false prophets, that is people who pretend to be prophets or predictors of future events, will arise during the coming tribulation. This does not refer to the false messiahs he spoke of in Matthew 24 verse 5, but to the prophets who would appear during the siege of Jerusalem. Josephus says, "The tyrannical zealots who ruled the city commanded many false prophets to declare that help would be given to the people from heaven. This was done to prevent them from trying to escape to the Romans and to inspire them to trust in God." Matthew 24 verse 12 says, "And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold." The word iniquity here seems to include the cruelty of the Jewish rulers inside the city, as well as the Romans who surrounded the city. We can add to this the harmful errors of false prophets and leaders. Number 8. "And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come." The proof that this was done must be derived mainly from the New Testament. Paul declares in Colossians 1 verse 5 to 6 that the gospel has reached the whole world. In Colossians 1 verse 23 he says, "He became a servant of the gospel which they heard and which was preached to all mankind under heaven." In Romans 1 verse 8, Paul says, "I thank my God through Jesus the Messiah for all of you, because the news about your faith is being reported throughout the world." Paul preached the gospel far and wide in all parts of what was to them the world. At the same time, the other apostles were not idle either. There is ample proof that within 30 years after this prophecy was spoken, congregations were established in all the regions. "Then shall the end come." This does not mean the end of the world. This marks the end of the Jewish economy or government in their God-given land, when Jerusalem and the temple, the heart of their existence, will be destroyed. All the things I mentioned so far, according to Jesus, will happen before the final sign, which will indicate the time has finally come for the fulfillment of his prophecy. "Not one stone here will be left on another, everyone will be thrown down." Jesus said, "When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, then let those in Judea flee into the mountains." The abomination of desolation. This is a Hebrew expression meaning an abominable or hateful destroyer. Now the Gentiles were all held in abhorrence by the Jews. Acts 10 verse 28. The abomination of desolation here is the Roman army. So how can I be sure of that? Well, because it is explained in clear and simple language by Luke. He says, "When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then you must know that its destruction is near." Luke 21 verse 20. The Roman army is further called the abomination based on the images of the emperor and the eagles which were carried in front of the legions and which were regarded by the Romans with divine honors. Mark says, "When you see the destructive desecration standing where it should not be. Now all of Jerusalem was regarded as holy, Matthew 4 verse 5. So the meaning of this is when you see the Roman army standing in or surrounding the holy city, or when you see the Roman ensigns or standards in the temple. Josephus says that when the city was taken, the Romans brought their idols into the temple and placed them over the eastern gate and sacrificed to them there. In other words, Jesus said, when you see the Roman armies coming towards Jerusalem, then flee into the mountains. Those followers of Jesus who paid attention to his prophecy and believed what he said would know that the time has come, and they knew that they had to flee up to a place of safety very quickly. Destruction would not only visit the city, but would spread to the surrounding parts of Judea. Take note that Jesus said, those which is in Judea, because those that were trapped in the city were doomed. They could not escape the wrath of the Roman armies. They had to flee to the mountains. In the mountains of Palestine are many caves, and these would be a safe refuge for those who are being pursued. In all the centuries, these caves were the favorite places of robbers, as well as a safe haven for those who were in danger. Read, amongst others, 1 Samuel 13 verse 6 and 21 verse 1. Jesus explains the urgency of the matter. He said, "Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house, neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes." In other words, run for your life and flee as fast as possible. Do not hesitate. These directions were followed. Eusebius wrote that when the revolt began in AD 66, some of the remaining Jewish Christians fled to Pella, a city across the Jordan River. He also says that there is no evidence that a single Christian perished in Jerusalem. That's from Eusebius, Ecclesiastical History, Book 3, Chapter 6. The Christians who were in Jerusalem fled from the city before the Roman army surrounded the city. That is, before the Romans stopped everyone who attempted to escape. Now Jesus, in his discourse on the Mount of Olives, utters the words that many well-meaning Christians pull out of context. He said, Matthew 24 verse 21, "For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been seen since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be." That was from the New King James Version. The New International Version reads, "For then there will be great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again." The Greek word thlipsis, translated tribulation in most English Bibles, is derived from its root word thlibu, which means pressure. Strong's dictionary shows it as persecution, affliction, distress, and tribulation. It can also be translated as anguish, difficulty, disaster, and severe suffering. However, all these words combined fall short of expressing the extreme horror that befell Jerusalem and Judea from the moment the Romans broke through the city's wall until they were finally satisfied that they have accomplished their goal. Luke says in Luke 21, "And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be taken captive to all the nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down by the nations until the times of the nations are fulfilled." That is, until the time given for the Gentiles to occupy the city is over, or as long as it pleases God to allow them to do so. The first thing mentioned by Luke is that they should fall by the edge of the sword, that is, would be slain in war, as the sword was then principally used in war. But it was far more horrendous than what being killed with a sword can be. Josephus, in describing it, almost used this very same words of Jesus. He says, "It appears to me that the misfortunes of all men from the beginning of the world, if they were compared to these of the Jews, are not so considerable as they were." In other words, all the calamities which had befallen any nation from the beginning of the world were but small in comparison with the calamities that befell the Jews. Josephus said that when the Romans finally became masters of the walls, they placed their ensigns upon the towers and made joyful acclamations for the victory they had gained. When they had gotten upon the last wall without any bloodshed, they could hardly believe what they found to be true, because there was nobody to oppose them. However, when they moved into the streets of the city with their swords drawn, they killed all they overtook, men, women, and children, without distinction of age, and set fire to the houses into which the Jews had fled, and they burnt every soul of them. When they came to plunder the other houses, they found in them entire families of dead people and rooms full of dead corpses of those who died of famine. They stood in horror at this sight and went out without touching anything. And though they thus pitied the dead, they had not the same emotion for the living, but killed all they met and blocked the streets with dead bodies. They made the whole city run down with blood to such a degree that the fire of many of the houses was quenched with these men's blood. He adds that in the siege of Jerusalem, not fewer than 1,100,000, that is 1,100,000, perish. In the adjacent provinces, no fewer than 250,000 are reckoned to have been slain. In total, 1,350,000 people were put to death. These were indeed not all slain with the sword. Many were crucified. Josephus says that many hundreds who escaped from the city because of the famine were first whipped by the Roman soldiers, then tormented with various kind of tortures, and finally crucified. The Roman soldiers nailed them. The Roman soldiers nailed them out of the wrath and hatred they bore to the Jews, one after one way and another after another, to crosses, by way of jest, until at length the multitude became so great that room was lacking for crosses and crosses for the bodies. In Matthew 27, verse 25, we read that at the trial of Jesus, the people answered Pilate and said, "Let his blood be on us and on our children." Could this have been the terrible fulfillment of the self-inflicted curse? If it be asked how it was possible for so many people to be slain in a single city, it is to be remembered that the siege of Jerusalem commenced during the time of the Passover, when all the males of the Jews were regarded to be there, and when it is estimated that more than 3 million were usually assembled, says Josephus. Concerning the famine that raged in the city, let me read to you what Josephus said about it, and I quote, "Now of those that died by famine in the city, the number was enormous, and the miseries they underwent were unspeakable. For if so much as the shadow of any kind of food did anywhere appear, friends died in fighting one with another about it. They snatched from each other the most miserable supports of life. Nor would men believe that those who were dying had no food, but the robbers would search the dying, lest anyone should have concealed food in their bosoms. These hungry robbers ran about stumbling and staggering among like mad dogs, and rushed into the very same houses 2 or 3 times in one and the same day. Moreover, the hunger was so intolerable that it compelled them to chew everything. They gathered things that even the most sordid animals would not touch, and endured to eat them. They chewed on girdles and shoes and the leather of their shields. The strands of old hay became food to some, and some gathered up fibres and sold a very small weight of them for 4 attics. But why, says Josephus, do I describe the shameless rudeness that the famine brought on men in their eating dead things? While I am going to relate a matter of fact, the like to which no history relates, either among the Greeks or barbarians, it is horrible to speak of and incredible when heard. Unquote. A horrible instance of the distress of Jerusalem is related by Josephus. The famine during the siege became so great that they ate what the most sordid animals refused to touch. Josephus says, a woman of distinguished rank, having been plundered by the soldiers in hunger, rage and despair, killed and roasted her own baby and had eaten one half of it before the deed was discovered. This cruel and dreadful act was also in fulfillment of prophecy recorded in Deuteronomy 28 verse 45 to 57. Let me read it to you as per the Good News translation. All these disasters will come on you, and they will be with you until you are destroyed, because you did not obey the Lord your God and keep all the laws that he gave you. They will be the evidence of God's judgment on you and your descendants forever. The Lord blessed you in every way, but you would not serve him with glad and joyful hearts. So then you will serve the enemies that the Lord is going to send against you. You will be hungry, thirsty, and naked, in need of everything. The Lord will oppress you harshly until you are destroyed. The Lord will bring against you a nation from the ends of the earth, a nation whose language you do not know. They will sweep down on you like an eagle. They will be ruthless and show no mercy to anyone, young or old. They will eat your livestock and your crops, and you will starve to death. They will not leave you any grain, wine, olive, oil, cattle or sheep, and you will die. They will attack every town in the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and the high fortified walls in which you trust will fall. When your enemies are besieging your towns, you will become so desperate for food that you will even eat the children that the Lord your God has given you. Even the most refined man of noble birth will become so desperate during the siege that he will eat some of his own children because he has no other food. He will not even give any to his brother or to the wife he loves or to any of his children who are left. Even the most refined woman of noble birth, so rich that she has never had to walk anywhere, will behave in the same way. When the enemy besieges her town, she will become so desperate for food that she will secretly eat her newborn child and the afterbirth as well. She will not share them with the husband she loves or with any of her children. Unquote. Another thing added by Luke 21 verse 24 was that they will be led away captive into all nations. Josephus informs us that the captives taken during the war amounted to 97,000. The tall and handsome young men Titus reserved for triumph. Of the rest, many were distributed through the Roman provinces to be destroyed by wild beasts in theatres. Many were sent to the works in Egypt, and many, especially those under 17 years of age, were sold for slaves. In Matthew 24:22 we read, "And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. For the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened." In other words, if the duration of this calamity would not be shortened, none of the nation would be preserved alive. All the inhabitants of Judea would perish. The war, famine, and pestilence would entirely destroy them. The elect in this verse probably refers to a very small minority in the city who followed the Lord their God with their whole heart. Jesus said that immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun shall be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. Matthew 24, verse 29. This is an indication that the great tribulation has come to an end, but trouble, affliction, tribulations, famine, pestilences, plagues, and wars will still appear until the very end. Yes, until our Lord Jesus returns again. The true children of God will experience all kinds of affliction, but we should not be discouraged. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 17 to 18, "This light, temporary nature of our suffering is producing for us an everlasting weight of glory far beyond any comparison, because we do not look for things that can be seen, but for things that cannot be seen. For things that can be seen are temporary, but things that cannot be seen are eternal." I will, by the grace of God, cover the return of Jesus Christ in the next podcast. Until then, may God bless you in Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior. Amen.